Today's program is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. For more information, visit RT11.com.
Hi, how are you? My name is Andrew WK. They say when things are very delicious, it must be Heritage Radio.
Network.org. I am your host, Alexis McLaughlin. Very excited to have you guys back for the first episode of our summer season. Unfortunately, we are not joined this week by co-host Philip Gilmore, but we are very gracious to have with us Kemruz Aram, who is a former sandwich artist of Subway, ramen connoisseur of Bushwick, and talented man and former guest of the show. Thanks, Kemruz.
Hi, thanks.
And, you know, I have to say we're also very excited to welcome in our guest of this week. He's a man of many accomplishments, a restaurateur of three establishments, the affable and lovable Philip Gilmore.
Oh, yay. Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
So we're role swapping today with Philip in the hot seat and just decided to try something new. Kemruz wanted to come in and delve into a bit of, you know, the story behind Phil and the man, the myth, the legend.
And I am not a professional, but Philip
not like us.
Yeah. No, I'm really happy to be here, and it's appropriate that, or maybe ironic, that I'm hosting someone who's been my host so many times at Momo and Moku Moku. As a host, I think like what's really interesting to me is that Philip is quite an entertainer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are very few people that I would allow to feed me the way that my mother did when I was a child. I mean, literally put food in my mouth.
A baby.
And so it'll be really fun to kind of talk with Philip about the story of Momo. And his life story, which I think is also very interesting. So maybe we can start at the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little bit that I know about your family life, but one of the things that we connected on early on when we first met is that you knew more about Iranian food than I would expect.
Mm-hmm.
And why is that?
Well, my mom's father, Grady Morris, was in the oil industry, so they moved around a lot. And actually, before oil, he was, I think, in the Air Force as well. So she traveled around a lot, and she was born in Beaumont, Texas, 1950. But then later on, you know, when she kind of became, you know, maybe like 8 or 9 years old, they started moving overseas. And so part of that, at the time, there was a big oil industry in Iran. So when she was a teenager, she lived in Iran. And they also lived in Libya as well. So my grandmother was a very modern woman. You know, I think by the time she died, she had 2 PhDs and 3 master's degrees. But also, she was a very worldly woman, but also loved cooking. So when she would go to these other countries or traveling or living places, she would, like, you know, learn how to cook the food. So I grew up around, like, you know, Moroccan food and, you know, Chinese food, but you know, like homemade, not just ordering takeout. So from an early age, I was very, very intrigued by food and, you know, international food as well, you know, so I had a taste for those things. And, you know, it's like, you know, we kind of covet what we can't have. So, you know,
yeah.
So
very few Americans are familiar with Iranian food.
Yeah.
So it was an interesting surprise that you knew what gourmet sabzi was, for example.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. So, yeah, so I grew up around, you know, I grew up around my grandmother cooking all the time. And, you know, I can, you know, still smell the flavors and the smells of the, you know, kitchen. And
but you didn't grow up overseas.
No. I grew up in, I was born in Kansas in 1972.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And what was that like?
It was, I don't know, what I can remember of it. Well, you know, the thing is that I lived there until I was about six. And then I grew up for, you know, my most of my childhood in South Florida. So it's kind of, that was kind of interesting because, you know, my foundation was in Wichita, but then I went from, you know, this Midwest, you know, kind of podunk town to living in, you know, Palm Beach County with, like, you know, swimming pools and movie stars.
And what was happening in Kansas City?
In Wichita?
I'm sorry, in Wichita. I'm sorry.
You know, my mom and dad, I was definitely like a product of a child. You know, I was a product of love. My mom and dad were like really in love with each other, kind of like hippies and very poor. But, you know, they both talk about it as like one of the happiest times in their life. Even though they were poor, they had this baby and this marriage. And then, they got into being Jehovah's Witnesses.
Oh, really?
And then my mom was a Jehovah's Witness until I was about three. But then she kind of didn't like it anymore. And then she didn't want to be a part of it. So that's why they got divorced, you know, disagreement on religion. So, I guess my grandparents felt bad for my mom. So they bought her a house. And so I was living
in Florida.
No, in Wichita at this point, when I'm like four. And it was interesting because I had, I basically had like five moms. She had all of her best friends living there. And I always joke, like, if you took one of them out of context, they would be a horrible mother. But all five of them together were like one and a half super moms.
Amazing.
You know? So, you know, always school on time, always clean clothes, always, you know, always, yeah, like.
They were all in their 20s or
something?
Yeah,
early 20s. Yeah. So it was kind of, you know, kind of party house.
But. So to feel like you were kind of growing up in a commune of sorts?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Beautiful women everywhere.
Yeah. And siblings?
At that point, no. My mother and father both remarried. And then, ironically enough, no sisters. Hmm. And then my dad had three boys, Joshua, Caleb, and Jonathan. And then my mother had two boys, Paul and Joseph.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm really close with all of them as well.
One of them's in Colorado, I believe.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah. One of them's outside of Boulder. One's in West Palm Beach, two are in Wichita, and one is in Arkansas. Yeah.
Is your mom listening?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Hello, Cheryl. Hello, hi, Cheryl. Sorry, Morris Sarkozy. Hello, Cheryl Morris Gilmore Sarkozy.
Is your dad still around?
Mm-hmm. My dad is. He's a very amazing man. He's a devout Jehovah's Witness, which, you know, he's very passionate about, and then he's also a carpenter. Like Jesus before him.
Yeah. Well, yeah. My condolences to your dad and all the Jehovah's Witnesses for the loss of one of their best.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Prince.
Oh, I forgot about that. Prince was Jehovah.
Yeah.
I was listening to Questlove interview.
Amazing. On Fresh Air?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I urge you, Cameroos, and anyone else to listen to the Questlove interview because he was, I guess he met Prince pretty early on and had some really great stories.
Yeah, there's one that's been animated that's quite funny.
What's that?
One of the stories that's been animated.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh, wow.
With his voiceover.
It's really neat how all the stories are coming out about how, like, secretly charitable Prince was,
mm-hmm.
You know? Like, there was something with some, it was some, you know, minorly famous jazz drummer that was very poor and he had some operations and he just got, like, you know, his wife got a check for like $300,000 and he, Prince said specifically, please don't tell anybody where the money came from. It's just like, when you hear stories like that, like, you know, people in the public eye are always going to be criticized or have a certain image. But then when you hear things like that, that has to be a good person.
Yeah. There's a Rumi poem or an English translation of a Rumi poem that says, if you were to wear your morality as if it were your best garments, you were better off naked.
Mm. There's also the Khalil Gibran quote.
Khalil Gibran.
Khalil Gibran. How did you say it? Khalil Gibran?
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's in the Prophet, and you know, it's the one about giving, and he says if somebody gives you a gift for the sake of recognition, you should refuse the gift and look at it as unholy.
Hmm.
Which is, like, I think the opposite of the stories we're hearing about Prince.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Of course. So let's fast forward to New York. I mean, maybe we could segue to New York. What happened? What happened? You know, what happened in between? Like, where did you live? How did you get from Florida to New York City?
Oh man, I don't even know.
take us on a whirlwind kind of.
Well, in the probably from like 1989 to 91, I kind of experimented with the thought of maybe going to college, and mm-hmm. I think I went to 4 different colleges.
Really?
Yeah, a couple community colleges, a couple regular colleges, and I guess kind of like didn't really have a focus of what I wanted to do. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, some people were helping me out, and then I was kind of, you know, paying for some of it myself. But at the end of the day, it's like I was, you know, looking at, $100,000 in a liberal arts degree, mm-hmm. which, you know, so I just kind of dedicated myself to, I've been working in restaurants since I was like 14. So I kind of, you know, when I was about 17 or 18, I kind of realized that I had an aptitude for waiting tables and I could, you know, make a living at it. So I kind of spent the majority of the whole 90s just being a bartender and waiter at different restaurants, and then trying to, you know, like either living at my mom's house or living like, you know, in communal situations where I could like save a lot of money and then use that for traveling, or in addition to that, like moving to another city and kind of like, you know, kind of a bohemian lifestyle.
Did you work in the kitchen at all?
I have. Mostly before I was 20, I had a few jobs where we worked at kitchens. My mm-hmm. first restaurant job was a place called Little Mermaid Seafood. It was just like, I think I was 14, and, you know, like frying fish sandwiches and,
right.
you know, making, you know, crab salad and that kind of stuff.
Right.
And I already, you know, loved cooking, but I kind of, growing up, my stepfather and my mother were, kind of living above their means. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a really great, cool house. And I kind of, in retrospect, I wish you would have said it's like this old, like maybe 20s Florida style, like old German neighborhood that kind of turned into the ghetto, but this really great house, and it was a really bad neighborhood. And I was getting ready to go to like junior high school, and the junior high school I would have gone to, it was like horrible, you know, really, you know, really
violent, the worst. Or how was it bad? Was it violent?
Just,
or,
yeah, just, you know, violent, and, you know, just horrible, horrible reputation of teachers mm-hmm. and, you know, incidents. And so they wanted to get out of the neighborhood anyway. So they bought a house in a nicer neighborhood that they couldn't quite afford. So, you know, when I'm like 12, 13, 14, 15, they both were having to work like 2 jobs. So I was home alone a lot. I also was, babysitting my 2 brothers. And then part of that was also cooking, like for myself and my little brothers, and even for them sometimes. So that kind of like, you know, I liked doing it, so I kind of got to experiment in the kitchen when I was like 13. So,
and what was your kind of like subcultural, I don't know, sensibility? Like, did you follow in the footsteps of your mother, and were you kind of a hippie, or did you skate? What was your thing?
It's Florida, so you know, I loved skateboarding. Mm-hmm. It was kind of interesting. The house in the nicer neighborhood that we moved to was called Azalea. And if I'm not mistaken, there are 30 houses on the one street, 15 on each side around there. And I think at one point there wasn't one girl that lived on the street. I'm talking about from like age 3 to 18. And I think at one point there were, I think I want to say 24 boys from age like 3 to 18. Hmm. So just a street with all boys, and it just like tons of, you know, there's a, the Florida, there's kumquat trees everywhere. So, mm-hmm. you know, we do this thing called Civil War where everybody would literally have a 5-gallon bucket of kumquats and just like stand in front of each other and hit each other. And, you know, there was tons of launch ramps and quarter pipes and half pipes. And then it's like, like almost every house has a pool. So it's not even if you have a pool, it's like who has the nicest pool and, you know, go fuck around there. And, you know,
what were you listening to?
Let's see. When I was 13, well, I got into skate culture, so I kind of, kind of halfway pretended that I liked punk rock, but, you know, I don't know, you know, like, the 7 Seconds and the Dead Kennedys and the Circle Jerks, and then that kind of led into, right around the same time, REM I got into, mm-hmm. Who else? I loved the B-52s,
right,
yeah. And then I got into, like, the Smithereens,
mm-hmm.
Then the Smiths, and then the whole thing. Yeah, those were kind of early on.
Yeah. And we had a long conversation recently about Prince as well.
Yeah.
It was very important to you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, I was listening to Prince, you know, when I was, gosh, I guess...
Six, seven.
No, I guess it would be, 11. Yeah. Yeah, maybe 12. Yeah. That was, he was neat to me.
Yeah, yeah, maybe that was, I'm a couple years younger than you. So when I first moved to the U.S., one of the first films I saw was Purple Rain.
Really?
Yeah.
That's wow. A nice introduction.
It was mind-blowing. Ooh. And my cousins and I, we all lived in the same house for a while, so we all got really... excited about, you know, when Purple Rain would come on. To, yeah. So let's bring you to New York. How did you end up in New York? And I mean, when I talk to people who know you, who knew you before I did, because we met when you first opened MoMA. We met one time before, but we didn't know until later. Yeah, we met at. There was
What was it?
You were picking up a friend's like CSA.
Yeah.
And you were just this really excited guy picking up the CSA who wanted to tell me about his Japanese restaurant that you were just about to open. And I was like, who is this character? You know? I mean, the energy, you know, you're just oozing with energy. And so so we came to the Japanese restaurant, and which was MoMA.
Yeah.
And I think we were among the first guests there. I was probably like one of the first people in the door.
Yeah.
And before you had a liquor license, before you're making any money, and we were just kind of blown away by the quality of the food.
Oh, man.
But as I started to kind of talk to people about you over the years, I kept hearing like, oh, you didn't know Philip back at Sweet Ups, because I used to go to Sweet Ups. I'm sure, you know, we ran into each other.
I was there like literally like 5 to 6 days a week from like 2003 to 2004.
So what year did you move to New York?
I moved here, I say 99, and then I always forget. It wasn't 99. In my mind, it was 99. It was basically kind of a blur because right last month in 1999, my best friend in the whole world died. Oh. This guy named Max. And actually yesterday was his birthday. And so it kind of, I was living in Atlanta, and it really kind of like... really kind of destroyed my life for about a year. And the weird part about it is you know, he came from a pretty affluent, wealthy family, and he was living in London, and he had just bought this like really like just huge like mansion or something in the middle of like some really cool neighborhood in London. And he was like, you got to move over here. I got this big house and you can stay here. And he wanted our other friend Gary and my little brother Paul to come over. And I was in Atlanta, and I was kind of done with Atlanta. I'd been there for like, you know, a year and a half. And I was trying to figure out whether or not my other best friend, Scott Smelser, had just moved to Boulder, Colorado. And I was kind of like playing around with either moving to Boulder or London. And Boulder kind of represented this kind of like, you know, mountain town, healthy, healing. And then London was kind of like this big city, kind of like craziness. And then so he died. So the decision was kind of made for me. Wow. So I moved to Boulder. And then my ex-girlfriend from high school, a girl named Kim, was living in New York at the time. And, you know, we kind of like, she also knew Max and you know, kind of by proxy through me. And so we kind of decided to, you know, to get back together. And so she wanted me to move to New York, and I wanted her to move to Boulder. So I was like, you know, you come to Boulder for a few months, and then if you don't like it, I'll move back to New York with you. And so...
She didn't like Boulder.
Yeah, she's a big city girl. So,
how old were you at this time?
At this point, I was 27.
Okay, yeah. So you moved to New York.
Yeah.
And what was your, you know, 27-year-old in New York? Did you have a goal? Did you have like an agenda for moving to New York?
Had you
been here before?
I'd been here many times. I actually the first time I came here was I think 1988. And my best friend in high school, a guy named Jordan, was actually born and raised in Bay Ridge, Bensonhurst, Sheepshead Bay, that whole area. Mm-hmm. And so we actually came up here and spent the summer in '88 in Brooklyn, which was kind of pretty intense.
Yeah.
It's like I'd already seen Do the Right Thing, and I'm like, ah, that's an exaggeration. And I get here in this, you know, Italian neighborhood, and I'm like, oh, God, everybody says the N-word a lot around here.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, like really intense, yeah. Wow. Like straight out of a movie. And I'm talking, you know, like it's like we're, like my friend Jordan's had a great aunt, they call her Aunt Sister, and she literally had a hat on her mantle, and it said, thanks, Johnny, with these little firecrackers. And it was actually, the name neighborhood that he was in for 4th of July, John Gotti would do this like parade with all his Cadillacs, and he would be in the convertible and he would throw out these hats and it says, "Thanks, Johnny." And so all the pizza and ice cream on all the corners were completely free.
Amazing.
And so like, you know, really intense.
Wow.
And so I'd been there first time in 88. And then actually just remembered a story. I actually saw this really cool piece of graffiti. I'll tell you where it is. I'll tell you the story later. But it kind of took me back to coming here. And I'd known about Andy Warhol a lot for some reason. And that led me to finding out about Basquiat and Keith Haring. So that summer that I spent here, I remember going to the original Pop Shop.
Hmm.
Do you know of the Pop Shop?
Vaguely.
Yeah, it was Keith Haring. When he was still alive, he had a thing called the Pop Shop.
Right.
And it was all the Keith Haring stuff. You can get you know, I don't know, matches and t-shirts and stickers, all Keith Haring. And it was in, I think it was in Soho. And, or maybe even, I want to say it was, yeah, I was in Soho. We went there and I spent my last $20. And I was still going to be here for 5 days. And I have to do it. And I spent my last $20 on a t-shirt. And then we were going from Soho to 89th in Lexington. And me and my friend also had only $20. And we spent our last $20 on the shirt. They let us get away with the tax because there was still tax on clothing back then. So it was supposed to be 21. And they let us have the shirt for $20. We got caught trying to sneak on the subway and got scared to death. The cops didn't arrest us and kicked us out of the subway for trying to jump the turnstile. And then we had to walk, and it was July, and it was 110 degrees. And we had to walk from Soho to 89th and Lexington, and it was just hot. And we had to stop at restaurants and beg for water. It was kind of intense. and then we just for the rest of the time, we literally, there was a bagel place near his house that sold day old bagels for six for a dollar. And we just basically ate bagels and raided his family's refrigerator for 5 days.
So you didn't move to New York with this goal,
I always said that I would never live.
I'm going to open a place called Momo.
No. I always said that I would never live in New York, and then it just ironically it happened. It kind of thrived from the moment I got here. You know, Williamsburg was kind of this burgeoning neighborhood, so I got a job at Diner,
mm-hmm.
as I have mentioned before.
Early 2000s?
Yeah, 2000. Yeah, and so
opened.
Yeah, when it first opened. So it kind of fell into that, and just the crowd there was just the absolute cool kids in the world.
Uh-huh. And were you serving?
I was bartending. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so... that kind of led to a lot of connections that I still have in my life and the neighborhood and everything. So,
and how did you come to Momo? I mean, I know that before that, I know the places you were before that. Why don't you walk us through that?
Well, that's kind of to the point is that, Mark and Andrew, the owners of Diner, mm-hmm. They were, before they opened Diner, they were the celebrity bartenders of Balthazar's and Odeon and that whole Keith McNally scene. And I saw that it was possible for them to be bartenders and save up a little money, beg, borrow, and steal, and open your own business. So it's always been a dream of mine. Even when I was 14, I'm gonna go to Cordon Bleu or I'm gonna go to CIA and be a chef. So it was always a dream to do something like that. But it's kind of a thing of it's half scared to death to do it. And then the other half, wait for the exact time and place and right opportunity.
Yeah.
I would say seriously, for about 3 years before Momo, I was really starting to get the itch to do my own place. But then that's kind of when the fear went away, and it was more about I want to wait until the exact time and place.
Yeah.
And, Roberta's had already opened, and I was waiting tables here and working at Bozu. So I saw that, I've been in this neighborhood mostly for the whole time I've been in New York. My first apartment was... five blocks that way on Willoughby and Wilson. So I've seen that the neighborhood, morph or whatever. And so, opening up a restaurant next to Roberta's and especially Japanese is just, kind of as sure of a bet as you can get.
Right. You're not stepping on anybody's toes.
Yeah.
You're
filling a void.
Yeah, exactly.
And
it's something you were familiar with through Bozu as well.
Yeah, exactly. I knew that I was going to be working at Bozu for the year that it took me to build and open the restaurant. So it's doing Japanese just seemed...
And for those people who don't know, Bozu is?
Is my friend and business partner, Makoto Suzuki's restaurant. And the kind of thing that people say about it is that it's actually more, it's more famous in Japan than it is in New York.
Really, is it?
Yeah. There's a lot of people that know Bozu in Japan.
Right.
But Oh, you know what I was going to say, though? It's one of the scary things, though. Do you guys remember Jean-Georges Steakhouse?
Yeah.
It was. It opened up in the Time Warner Center. It was when, you know, the flagship restaurants of the Time Warner Center were going to be, you know, Per Se, Masa, and Jean-Georges Steakhouse. So for those who don't know about failed restaurants and the risk of it, is you have Danny Myers, the greatest restaurateur ever in the past and the future. You have Jean-Georges, one of the best and most famous chefs in the world. You have this address, which is the most affluent thing in the world at the time, and then you have Thomas Keller, who owns the best at the time, the best restaurant in the United States was French Laundry. You have him opening up his second restaurant. You have Masa, probably the greatest sushi chef in America, opening up this. And so it's like, and then you have lighting architects, you have furniture makers, you have custom plates, you have sound architects, lighting architects, sound, you know, all these things, and with all this dream team. And then the fucking restaurant closes in 6 months.
Right.
That's, and then, but my restaurant's a sure thing. That's scary to me. You know, that was right. Like one of the things of like restaurants, it's cliche, you know, like I hear people spell, you know, 90% of all restaurants in New York close in the first 2 days, you know,
right,
it's,
sure.
It's not that bad, but it's scary. So, you know, but I kind of like got over the fear aspect.
Right. Well, something that, you know, even though, many visitors to Momo may find like some of the items a little bit expensive, especially for the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Something that I've always noticed is that the quality of food that you get, you're able to provide people with the quality at a lesser price than, you know, the Time Warner building.
Yeah, the other thing is, man, it's like it's for every one person that says that Momo is overpriced or they think it's expensive, I get three people saying that, like, oh my God, your food is so cheap for what we're getting.
Yeah.
Like, if you know about, you know, Japanese rice, or if you know about the when you get the sashimi plate, there's daikon. It's like, we don't just buy that daikon. We have to peel the daikon. We have to, you know, spin it in the wheel, and then we have to keep it in water. And it's like all these things that, like, you know, that we try to stay true to like true Japanese concepts, but even the miso soup, it's like, we're not buying, you know, dry. We're using fresh miso and making the broth from, you know, from kombu kelp and dried shiitake mushrooms and doing the stock for a couple hours first and like making it to order, you know? So it's like, if you know what goes into what you're eating, you'll be pleasantly surprised with the prices at Momo Sushi Shack at 43 Bogart in Brooklyn, New York.
Not to mention the best salmon I've ever had in my life.
Yeah.
You know? And a proper pour for sake. You know, yeah. It's not like a little thimble. You get a glass of sake. So cool. I think that you're able to provide that. I mean, you're talking about early days of Bushwick. I had my first studio in Bushwick in 2003. And so, you know, I saw the change happening as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you opened Momo up, it was at a time where, you know, the leases are much different now, let's put it that way, than they were. What year was that when you opened Momo? 2009?
10. No, well, 10. I got the lease in July of 2009 and opened August 2010.
Right, right. So it's a bit of a different world, and I think that perhaps that's allowed you to provide the quality of food.
Yeah.
Which is nice, you know, that... there's something that makes that quality of food more accessible to people like myself.
Yeah. I think what the icing on top of the cake was when the Clintons were here at Roberta's. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
What's that story?
I think it was a fundraiser for somebody, and the Clintons were the guests. Huh. But it was kind of like, oh, wow, yeah, Bushwick's arrived.
Yeah.
Was there anything when you were opening Momo that you knew you were doing right? Or was there anything, like any directions that you had to stop and kind of change? Because it's like, this isn't working.
I was 100% faking it. I would say the one thing that I'm most proud of that worked out good that we didn't rush is one of the reasons it took like 13 months is A, I had no fucking idea what I was doing. But the one thing that I'm super happy with is we took literally 2.5 months in just designing the layout of the space. And when I say designing, and I'm talking about hundreds and hundreds of, you know, pieces of graph paper and with rulers and markers and, you know, really laying it out. And, you know, people can sometimes complain about the communal seating, but, you know, my dining room is only like 300 square feet. Right. And And it's just like...
And it seats how many people? Like
36. 36
people. Okay.
So the thing is that I dedicated over 50% of the restaurant to the kitchen and bar, which makes people work there work more efficiently. The communal tables is, you know, being able to seat the most people in the small space. And
they're also the most gorgeous... solid wood live edge.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like that, from a single tree. Like.
Yeah. Yeah. My friend Rob, helped me do that. We got a whole black walnut tree and you know, those tables, honestly, like not exaggeration. Those tables, if I didn't know my friend Rob, if he didn't design them for me, if he didn't cure the wood, he didn't do all that those tables would cost $100,000. And without a doubt, you know, they did it, you know, Nakashima style dovetails, the butterflies, the live edge.
It's unbelievable.
And the quality of the black walnut. And you'll notice sometimes there's kind of like a dull finish on it.
Yeah.
The reason why is because we did an experiment with the piece of the black walnut and this is what it looks like completely polished and finished. And it was too fancy for the restaurant. It would make it look like almost out of place. So I just went with no finish, just a very like, you know, simple Dutch oil. Cause like those finished, it's like, it's kind of spectacular, but it almost was too good for the restaurant.
Like distracting.
Yeah. But then also, you know, the design of the restaurant I was very happy with. But one of the things you might notice is, you know, the corrugated steel ceilings. Mm-hmm. Those aren't original. Those are I did that. And, you know, we did it. I tried to buy used ones, but you would think buying used corrugated, you know, that stuff would be really easy. It took me a month to find use and it doesn't exist. Like the people that have all, I went into the really like old, weather beaten, rusted, you know, stuff that like, you know, all the scaffolding companies have. Sure. The people that have that, I'm offering them like $2,000 for like five pieces that cost them $100 and it's nothing to them. They're like, we don't want your money.
Wow.
It's like, I wanted to buy this stuff and offering like, you know, five times what it's worth and nobody would sell it to me. So then we just had to get new stuff and we did a thing where you put like black vinegar and lemon juice and let it sit out in the sun.
Right.
Oh, but what I was going to say though is the ceilings are actually about 3 feet higher. So the thing is that I was looking at the space and the room was a cube.
Right.
And then it looked like too small. So then I lowered the ceiling. So when you walk in, it looks longer because of the lowered ceilings.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And it feels smart. A little bit more cozy.
Yeah. So like little things like that. And, you know, I you know, was reading like, you know, all sorts of blogs, you know, or like things about restaurant design and, you know, concepts and architecture and stuff like that.
So tell me, how did, first of all, you've never been to Japan.
Yes, that is correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
And, we'll talk about that a little bit, how you kind of got into, obviously, like, one of your partners is Japanese.
Yeah.
And then maybe tell us a little bit about your partners.
Well. So Makoto...
As well as for Hi Hello, because I want to get into that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Bit,
so, yeah. Makoto Suzuki owns Bozu. I was working at, like, Sweet Ups and Boogaloo as kind of like a bartender. And they kind of like, you know, that just got tiring, you know, the whole lifestyle of, you know, going to sleep at 6 o'clock in the morning every night. So I asked Makoto, if I could work at Bozu as a waiter. He said yes. And I was like basically the only like, you know, non-Japanese person working there. And so, I actually remember the two things that really, it was when I was first going to maybe start working there and we were meeting. He gave me two things. One was a sake called Yuki no Bosha. I had never had really great sake before. And like drinking that for the first time just like blew me away. I fell in love with sake at that exact moment. Like I didn't know it existed. And I remember the dish he served me was something called Amaebi Shiokara, which is a sweet rock shrimp. You peel it, you take the raw meat out and put it in a bowl, and then you take the heads and then you squeeze the guts and brains of the shrimp onto the shrimp meat and then you let it ferment for a couple days. Mm-hmm. And I ate that and then I knew way less than you guys know about Japanese food now. I knew about, you know, spicy tuna roll. I was a dumbass that would put the, you know, wasabi and soy sauce in my miso soup. I didn't know any of the etiquette. But, like, tasting sake and tasting that Amaebi Shiokara was like, kind of, like, put its hooks in me. And then working at Bozu for 2 years, I just wanted to learn more and more about all the, you know, foods and... You know, a lot of people think a lot of things about me. Like one of the things they think I am a chef, which I never claimed to be. Mm-hmm. And if people think I am, I'm honored, but I'm not. And if anybody ever talks to me about it, I say I am not a chef.
Right.
Like I have chefs and they're geniuses, and you know, I can fucking cook. I can come up with dishes, but I'm not a chef. But
I always think of you as an entertainer.
Yeah,
you know, because you're the way that you host. You know, the way that your presence at Momo
that's
really
my strength. That's my strength.
It's like an old school style of hosting too that isn't as common anymore. Just being really, really gregarious, really on the floor, really present.
Like a cross between like a maitre d' and some like drunk clown at the Moulin Rouge.
Exactly.
I'll take it.
But it's all, I mean, the thing that's beautiful about it is that it's all very sincere. It's not, I mean, you're performing as much as any of us perform our own personalities, but you know, it's all very you, and it's, you know, there's something like it could be overbearing, like it could be, and you know just when to turn it down.
But even the
and
times
sometimes you push it a little bit.
But then it's just like, okay, well, don't come back here ever again.
Right.
You know, like you know, I've been in many situations where, you know, I'm at really nice restaurants and they're not overbearing enough. Like, I'm paying $150 for this meal. Can you tell me a story, or, you know, can you tell me at least, like, you know, point to a P and be like, that's an English P. Thanks. You know, drop it by,
What I mean is, like, you're not, you know, when you talk about the food, it's a very sincere love for that food.
It's 100%.
You know, when you're talking about where the food is coming from, you're not putting on a show. You're not selling, you know, a dish.
It all feels sincere.
Well, here's the thing. It's like, you know, Alexis works for, you know, Patrick and Heritage Foods and all that. But when you hear some of the stories of what some of these farmers are doing, the links that they go to. It's almost like that shrimp dish. It's like, or the thing I was talking about, our miso soup or the daikon. It's like. You're eating this, but there's like, this was not taken out of a plastic bag and put in a fucking microwave.
Right.
There's a story behind this item that we're getting. Like, you know, the pork, like if we're, you know, red wattle pork, you know, a few years ago, there's only a few hundred left in the United States. It's this great, great, beautiful breed of pig, but people weren't raising it because you can't just put it in a pen with 10,000 pigs and feed it slop. You have to care for them. They're finicky. They're really intelligent. They have a different immune system. So nobody was raising these pigs. And so now the kind of tagline for Red Wattle is "Eat me to save me." So when I think any moral human being, kind of in the back of their mind when they're eating meat, they're like, oh, you know, pigs are more intelligent than dogs and they're so cute. But it's just like this pork, A, it's fucking delicious, but B, it's like you're actually saving this breed by eating this. So it's like, you know, it's like I want people to feel good about, you know, eating this sentient being.
Right.
You do an amazing job with education. I think that was like the best spiel that has ever been said about like heritage breeds and just like the impact on it.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing is they think that people think that, you know, I'm, what do they think? They think that I studied in Japan. They think I've never actually had a Japanese girlfriend, but people think that I've, you know, oh man, you must have really, you know, you must have had some, you know, really good, you know, like beautiful Japanese girlfriend. Never had a Japanese girlfriend. I don't speak Japanese. I've never been to Japan. I love Japanese food. I love sake. I love the culture. But my favorite thing in the world is jerk chicken. I love Persian food. I love northern Spanish food. Might be my favorite food in the world. So I'm not like, you know, as far as food goes, I'm not some like Japanese crazed, you know.
Right. Right.
You know, like, oh, everything I do is Japanese. No,
right.
It's like I own a Japanese restaurant and I like it. And
right.
Yeah.
And you also have Moku Moku next door.
Moku Moku, yeah.
And you have Hi Hello.
Hi Hello.
Yeah.
Yes.
With Kip.
Yes. With
Kip. Let's take a quick break.
And then we'll come back and talk
then
about.
We'll come back and talk about Hi Hello and Moku Moku.
Oh,
great.
Yeah.
Time flies.
The following program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 potato chips dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate. An incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believes comfort food should be just that. Know where your food comes from. For more information, visit RT11.com.
Where your food comes from.
Hi. We're back with the main course. We are interviewing Philip Gilmore, who's normally in the host seat, but today he is a guest. Kim Ruzaram, taking it away with questions.
Yeah, I'm literally in Philip's seat.
We actually
did switch seats.
We did. Yeah.
It's important. You need like the physical, you know, like power dynamic of looking down onto the guest.
This is the chair of submission.
Yeah. So we were just talking about your partners in the business.
Yeah.
I think it's been over a year, hasn't it?
It's been a little over a year. Hi, hello, yeah.
Yeah, you opened, and it was in progress for quite a bit longer than that.
It was a nightmare. It was the thing that I talked about, the fear of, like, everything can go wrong in a restaurant. Whoops, it happened.
Right, right. But let's talk about that, because where did you meet Kip? Kip used to work
Kip Michelle, my business partner in Hi Hello, was the service director here at Roberta's. And, you know, he's like, you know, he's one of those stories of, like, you know, he starts here and just boom, boom, boom. He's such a, you know, genuinely nice human being and such a hard worker. Us Kansas boys are like that. He's from Wichita, Kansas, which we bonded on that. And, you know, his position here, every 6 months, he'd, you know, move up the ladder here until he was the service director. And, we probably about a year and a half before we even talked about, before we actually, you know, talked about doing Hi Hello. We'd always talked about doing originally the concept was that we'd open a bar called Joyland. And that's the amusement park that we both grew up going to in Wichita, Kansas.
That's interesting. I never knew about this.
Yeah, nobody does. So Joyland was this very special kind of, like, think about the cyclone in Coney Island, that kind of style, old school, like, you know, 20s or 30s, you know, old beat up bumper cars and, you know, carnival games, like really just Midwestern, probably 20s or 30s, maybe even 40s, like amusement park. So we both grew up going there, called Joyland. And then towards the end of it, they tried to, like, modernize it, which is just, you know, didn't work out. So now it's closed. But we always talked about, like, kind of half jokingly, half serious, like, let's do a bar called Joyland. And so he had put in his notes at Roberta's, and he literally was, I think, was he already gone? No, he was, like, leaving for like a month long vacation the next day. And I found out about Mazzell's, was, you know, a bar there was, that didn't do so well, and it was up for sale. And I basically just called him and said, we're going to buy Mazzell's, and do you want to do it? And he's like, yes.
Wow.
Just with a, you know, just snap decision. And
we being you and Chance.
Me and Chance, my business partner, Chance Johnson. We were kind of like itching in a new place, and this just time and place. It's like you couldn't pick a better address. It's right on the corner of Wyckoff and Star, right, you know, two steps, literally 2 feet from the subway. And
can we take a small side road
and
tell us a little bit about Chance and how you met?
Chance, yes. I was working at a place called Olioli, and he was building his bar called Bulu that was open for about eight years. Kind of like, you know, it was kind of actually the birth of the first dubstep parties in New York happened there. And kind of, you know, had, you know, just crazy stories. Like, you know The Fall? The
band? Sure, yeah.
Their first time they performed, like, you know, after years of being on hiatus, was that Boogaloo.
Oh, amazing.
You know, and TV on the Radio, and all those people, like, all played there and, you know, hung out there. And so, but going back to, like, 2000, 2001, Chance was building his bar Boogaloo with his girlfriend at the time named Tammy Sue Green. And he would actually, he was, you know, a really interesting guy. And I just knew him because he would call on Mondays. We would have oysters, and they'd be at the, you know, building the bar all day. And he'd call me at like 8 o'clock and say, how many oysters do you have? And I was like, oh, I think we have about, you know, I think like probably 70 left. And he's like, okay, don't sell anymore. And then he'd like, sometimes, you know, we closed at 11. Sometimes he'd show up like 10:50 or 11:05. But if he called, he always showed up. And then him and Tammy would eat all the oysters.
Amazing.
So they kind of like, I'm like, oh, yeah, I guess I'm in love with this guy. Yeah. And then, yeah, just friendship sprouted from that.
Very close. Yeah. And so, so you and Chance kind of, you bought Mazel from the former owners.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then, well, and it's kind of interesting because I actually learned about, through my attorney, Kenneth Belkin, I learned about, doing business deals internationally, because Kip was actually in, I think, Denmark and Sweden and I think maybe Finland or Norway. I'm kind of, he was basically right around, you know, because his mother is Swedish.
Right.
And so he has family over there. So he's, I think, mostly Sweden, and then they kind of traveled around. But he was over there for like a month and a half, I think. And so we had to do like wire transfers and like, you know, power of attorney and, you know, co-signing and signing for him and like, you know, doing all this, you know, setting up bank accounts corporation with him in Europe. Right. So that was kind of interesting.
What's fascinating is I remember before Mazel, there was a Buffalo Cantina.
Before Buffalo Cantina,
there was this place where before even Northeast Kingdom was open, it was the only place, it was right off the subway, it's the only place that I could find to get lunch.
Yeah.
That or the Tortilla Factory.
Yeah.
And I would go there for lunch sometimes. And one time I remember I asked them, you know, what the stew was, because it was one of those places that just has the
hot plates.
Yeah. And
steam trays, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And he said, cabbage. And I said, okay, that sounds like pretty safe. So I got the cabbage and I took it back to my studio. And I opened it up to find that it was like, you know, when fish is served like just chopped in cross sections, like just no consideration. It's just like a whole fish chopped in cross sections with the spine. And it was like the gnarliest, like most overcooked kind of pungent fish. I didn't get ill, but
only if you thought about it.
Only if I thought of it, still to this day. Yeah. So, you know, that was what's fascinating to me is that that location was kind of doomed because, well, that place was there for a while. But then when Buffalo Cantina came, that was just a very brief moment. And then Mazel was quite brief as well.
Yeah, about a year.
Nobody had quite sorted out like how to work this ideal location. It was just like literally above the Jefferson Station.
I'm still confused about Buffalo Cantina, because the original one that was on Havemeyer, that was like, it was so good. It was so good at the time. And it was the guy Wayne, which I haven't seen him in years, but like they was like some of the best wings I've ever had. And they were on like a couple, you know, Food Network shows, because they had like the, you know, I don't know, the Atomic or 911 or whatever they called them, like the hottest wings in America thing. Right. And like, you know, if you ate five of them, you got them for free, but you can't, it's impossible. But they was a really, really great place. And then
I ate there a couple times at the,
it was the worst.
It was terrible.
It was the fucking worst. Yeah.
And so
it was the Mazels of chicken wings.
Was it simultaneous to the place being on Havemeyer, or did they move from Havemeyer?
No, yeah, it, the
so
one
it was on, like an outpost. Or?
Yeah, the one on Havemeyer, I'm going to say probably opened up in like 2000 and probably 5 or 6, and maybe even
it's gone now though.
Yeah, it's completely gone, and it's opened like 2006 maybe, and then the one over there opened up in 2000 and probably 9 or 10,
something like that.
And then
you didn't take the lease, you bought the
lease. Yeah, we bought the lease.
Yeah. And you had quite a journey, I remember, to get the place going, because there were things that had to be done.
Well kind of in the times, because even before the Puerto Rican place or whatever that place was, it was also used to be some sort of like, when I first moved there, because that was my subway stop in 2000.
Right.
You know, I lived on Willoughby and Wilson, so that's the closest train. And it used to be, I remember it as like some sort of like Puerto Rican social club. Like, I think I went in there once accidentally, and then I never looked at it again. It was like, you know, pool table, people smoking, and like kind of bikers.
Ah, that rings a bell. Yeah.
And then I think it kind of like, you know, a couple of years later switched over to that thing. But I think the thing is, though, it was in some way or another some sort of restaurant and bars for decades. Mm-hmm. And the thing about it is when you're doing construction in New York, you gotta, you know, when you're doing construction in New York, there's risks that you can or cannot take. And one of the things is, you do a thing called like self-cert, which is the architect or the plumber or the construction guy says, I approve this. And then there's like a 50-50 chance that the DOB will come and inspect it. But if they don't come inspect it because the contractor or the plumber, whoever, has self-certified it, it's now legal. And then they don't come back. But the thing is that 10 years ago, 20 years ago, there was, like you said, there was no restaurants out here. So the chances that the Department of Buildings are going to come all the way to Bushwick to inspect some $40,000 restaurant is zero. There's zero chance they're going to come.
Right.
Because there's no, because they have to spend an hour and a half just getting here, where they could be fucking with, you know, people in Soho or, you know,
right,
or people even in Williamsburg or people in, you know, where
with money to pay fines.
Yeah.
As well.
Well, yeah. Exactly. Money to pay fines, and you can do like 5 appointments in one day. So the thing is that everybody before us, including Mazzell's, nobody did anything legal.
Oh, right.
So we assumed that everything had, and then it wasn't. Just like, you know, one thing after another had been done illegally. So we would do things like do the plumbing. And then they'd be like, okay, we're, oh, one of the things was like, we were upgrading the plumbing.
Right.
You know, and then they said, okay, here's your, you know, license to upgrade the plumbing. And then you have to close out the job. And then they say, oh, you can't close this. There's no pre-existing plumbing.
Hmm.
So then we have to, like, you know, open the floors and walls up after we'd already closed them.
Right.
You know, just like that kind of stuff times like 10. So.
Right. So like the one person in that location that decides to do things right,
mm-hmm,
is the one that has to
gets
go
fucked
through.
Yeah. We had to pay for everybody's fuck up. So.
Yeah, exactly. Over like decades. Right. Yeah. Okay. So you opened the place and it's a fantastic, I mean, for those who don't know, it's like what I referred to as a classic cafe, like a European style cafe.
Exactly. That's where we wanted somewhere where adults can hang out.
Adults can hang out, yeah. Exactly. And it's a bar, so you can have drinks, great coffee.
We use Victoria coffee, and we have the Death Star machine over there.
Yeah.
Great
and
spot.
I always go in, I don't know what to call it. Kip makes this thing, I always call it a Kip cafe.
Oh yeah.
And it's like somewhere in between a cortado and a macchiato.
Yeah.
But it's a wonderful sandwich shop. It makes sense. I mean, what was the idea behind, like, I think you've talked about this in the press, maybe we don't need to get too far into it.
Yeah, well, you know, just doing kind of like, you know, a place that just kind of great sandwiches, but we do have cocktails there, but we wanted to kind of get away from the whole, you know, artisanal, you know, cool cocktail thing, because I think that's kind of dead in my mind. I mean, no offense to anybody that's into that scene, but have a couple great cocktails, really focus on great beers, and like also like, you know, kind of like, you know, great aperitifs and digestifs, and you know, kind of like kind of stuff that we like.
Yeah. And Kip has a great wine knowledge. So
he does. He does. You know, he loves wine and he loves everything. He's like a textbook of all things.
Right. Yeah.
I'm always amazed with Kip because it's not only wine. It's who was it? My ex-girlfriend, Jordan, who lived in Maine, that was talking about her mother's house, and it's some architect, and like, you know, and like Kip's into architecture, and then he's like, something, I have no idea who, and he's like, oh yeah, he's the guy that does the soffits and blah blah blah, you know, like he's literally a textbook about all things. It's great.
I can talk to him about art as well. He has the knowledge that
he knows.
It's really wonderful. It's a place where everybody knows my name.
Yeah, yeah, literally.
Literally. I mean, it's interesting. Yeah. So there's, you know, as we kind of wind down this episode, this week's show is, maybe I want to talk about you a little bit personally.
Sure.
I don't know if you mind getting like a little bit personal.
No, I love it.
But one of the things that's really interesting to me is that, you know, there's, you're this incredibly joyful person who's who presents this this really vibrant energy, and you entertain people, you make people happy, you mm-hmm. know, and you feed people,
yes.
you know, and it all comes from this place of love.
Yeah.
And recently I was thinking about this, and I thought about the Smokey Robinson song Tracks of My Tears.
Uh-huh.
You know that
yeah,
song?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I thought, like, there is, like, something, you know, like, I wonder if there's a, there's, I know you pretty well, you know, and you're
yeah.
a very joyful person.
Yeah.
But, there's also a melancholy there.
Of
that's,
course.
That's underneath it all. And I think, like, sometimes, you know, maybe it's a little bit old-fashioned to put it this way, but I think some of the most beautiful art comes out of a deep sadness.
Of course. I know what you're going to say. I know what you're talking about, so I think I can address it. So, first of all, one of the things was I've kind of had this personality my whole life. And when I was about 20, I think I've even talked about this on air before, but when I was maybe about 22 or 23, I was curious because I've always been the guy that can walk into a party full of strangers, full of 60-year-old billionaires or homeless drug addicts. I can walk into a room and I can find out everybody's name. I can, you know, I can make people, I can just automatically start a conversation. I can get people to trust me. It's kind of like, you know, out of context, I used to think it was like, oh my, I'm some sort of like con man trying to overcompensate for something, you know, something deep inside me and sad,
right.
You know, because that is a possibility. But one of the things that I was asking my mom about, like, you know, like I was kind of getting into like, you know, experimenting with, you know, hallucinogens and also reading about psychology and all that stuff. I started asking my mom, like, what was I like before my, you know, my ego and my id started developing, you know, like, you know, when I'm like two. And she told me this story. I think she kind of intuitively knew what I was aiming at, like, who am I? What am I? And she told me this story about I was about 2 years old, you know, barely walking, or maybe two and a half. And we were on a beach in Florida somewhere, and I kind of was, like, walking ahead of my parents. And there was this young couple that were sitting down on a blanket and having, like, kind of, like, you know, wine and cheese kind of thing. And I walk up to them, and I say, hi, my name's Soap, and I shake their hands, and then I sit down and I start eating their fruit. And when she told me that story, I'm like, that reminds me of somebody I know. It reminds me of me, you know?
Yeah.
And so, but in relation to, like, Momo thing, it's like, it's, you know, I have a lot of stress in my life. I'm juggling three restaurants. It's, you know, the whole debacle with Hi Hello has put me into, it's like, debt. And, you know, I have stress and I'm not a perfect human being. But the thing at the end of the day, though, is I'm also a businessman. And I do have the ability to be that host, the thing you're talking about, feeding people, you know, making people happy. So the thing is on one hand, sometimes it is a tiny bit contrived. But the thing is, I'm also a businessman, and I have this thing that I do at my restaurant, and so it doesn't make sense for me to come to the restaurant and then be melancholy or sad. So you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So you know, there are times where you know I don't necessarily think that I'm ever truly, you know, because I've dealt with people that are truly depressed and have
right.
certain, you know, certain things in their life, but. You know, if I am going in that, you know, direction, if I am super sad, I just stay home, you know,
yeah.
You know, cause it's like, it's like what I was saying, like when you go to a restaurant, you spend money, it's like, it's just like, wait, I'm tipping you. You just made me depressed. I like, you like, I feel I came into this restaurant having this nice experience and now I feel sadder than when yeah. I came here, you know? So it's just like, you know,
well, I think there's, you know, there's an element of, I think some of the best in art, you know, as we get older, we develop like an intellectual approach and a methodology to the things that we do.
Yeah.
But I think some of the best artists, and I bring up artists because I think that there's an art in what you do. Some of the best artists have a direct line into that feeling or the things that moved you when you were like 14,
yeah.
You know, and there's a sensitivity that a 14-year-old has or 13-year-old or 15-year-old, that gets lost as we kind of grow up and start to think more logically and more responsibly. And I think that there is an openness and sensitivity that, that early teenagers have, that is really important to, a creative being.
Yeah.
And I think that that's something that I sense in the way that you host. It's like a forever young kind of thing.
I'll accept that.
There's this quote I read written on a baseball in Sharpie marker that just said, true genius or brilliance is the ability to recall one's childhood as an adult.
Mm.
Which I always appreciated, because it's just being able to transport yourself or not losing touch with what you were, or you know, that development, that imaginative mind.
And it's an emotional recollection. It's not remembering events.
The moments. It's like, how did this make me feel the first time you heard Beastie Boys or whatever that seminal moment was.
Absolutely.
Interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Man.
Well.
Yeah.
Anything else?
It's amazing, because we've been sitting here. We started the show early, and we've been sitting here for a long time talking back and forth, mostly listening to you talk. And I still feel like there's another hour's worth of questions.
We can do a part two. I'm ready. I'm an open book.
Yeah.
it's endlessly fascinating. I really love listening to your stories.
Oh, man. Well, thank you.
And also
there are stories we haven't heard yet.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like we didn't even get into stories, so to speak. Yeah. It's just like, you know, how are you here?
Yeah.
And how is it a thing?
Yeah.
We only started to get into the Philip.
There's an introduction to Philip Gilmore.
Yeah.
Next one is Philip Gilmore stories.
Yes.
So
I gotta say though, Camruz, you did an amazing job as an interviewer.
Oh, thank you. Well,
like that's a legit skill. Does that come from lecturing or professorship?
No.
Have you ever interviewed anybody?
No, this is my first time.
Not even for like a magazine or anything like that?
I've only been on the other end.
Oh, really?
And you may have heard throughout the show several things drop. that's just me not knowing what I'm doing, and my umbrella falling over and dropping my pen and whatnot. I have no experience with this. You say I did a good job, but I don't believe you.
No, you did a fantastic job.
That's a sign of true genius. Like, I'm an idiot. I'm a failure. but I think also too, you have, because of because you're the best artist in the world, best painter in the world. Because of that, you have been interviewed a lot. You know, you have done a lot of interviews, and also too, forwards to your books and that kind of stuff. So, being on the receiving end of that is kind of almost makes you. That's half of the battle right there. You know, being on the receiving end, you've been the interviewee, so it's kind of like you have a natural ability.
How does that feel for you? The shift between, just going to the interview position from being someone that's familiar with being interviewed.
To be honest, it's less stressful to be the one interviewing.
Yeah.
And it's, I get to delve into my curiosities about Phil.
No, Camruz, what about your childhood? No, Camruz, what about your insecurities?
Because it's what it is that, today it's an opportunity for Philip to represent himself and for me to ask those questions. However, when it's somebody asking me and it's time for me to represent myself, there's a lot more stress in that. There's a lot.
I don't know. No. I don't know. I can't remember.
Yes. No.
Can I ask you guys both one of my favorite questions to ask people when I first meet them?
Yes.
What is your fear? And I usually like to preface it by, like, what is your irrational fear? Like, what is the thing that you know better but you can't help but be afraid of? Because, I mean, bears, like, they're just fucking scary, but...
I think kind of what you were saying about your interviewing style is that, people are going to find out I'm a fake. People are going to, think I'm a fake or I'm a failure or, or actually just failing,
That's very interesting you bring that up. I have that severely. There are many moments in my life where I think people are going to find out that I'm full of shit. And, I've been doing this for... I've been doing this for this being making art professionally, if you put it that way, for a good 12, 13 years. And it's like, to this day, I still think, people are going to find out.
I'm going to tell a quick story. And it kind of on the same page on that. You guys know Hector Marcel. Mm-hmm. You know, he's, you know, a Buddhist meditation teacher. And his day job for many years was he was a corporate mediator. So he'd go into, like, Fortune 500 companies and, like, you know, kind of mediate pissing contests before those, you know, the CFO and the CEO. And I it was early on in Momo, probably about 6 months in. And I knew that he did that. And I kind of had this, like, irrational fear that kept repeating in my mind. And I wanted to ask him about it. And I sat down with him and I was like, hey, you know, can you, this is when we first met and, you know, started becoming friends. And I was like, hey, I want to talk to you. Can, you know, can you get to work at four? Can you come and talk to me? We sit down. He was, like, kind of nonchalant. I'm like, okay, what do you want to talk about? And I started speaking. He's like, I already know what you're going to say. I'm like, no, you don't. Like, he's like, I know why I'm here. I know what you're going to say. Really, like, kind of, like, kind of almost condescending. Yeah, I know what you're going to say. Can we just get over, you know, let's just get this over with. And I was like, there's no way. And we kind of went back and forth. I'm like, okay, you tell me, Mr. Wise Bearded Man. He's like, you think that you're faking it and you think everybody's going to find out that you're faking it. And you have no idea what you're doing. And he said that the reason he knew I was going to say that is in private with, like, CEOs, it's the number one thing that successful people tell him.
Wow.
Is that I'm afraid that somebody's going to find out I'm faking it. Hmm. And, but it's the kind of the compliment, though, is it's a sign of a highly successful human being.
Right.
You know, somebody says, I know what I'm doing. That's like, you're not questioning yourself. And the whole point is to, like, you know, kind of put that fire out and use that energy to be actually better. Nobody knows what they're doing. Everybody's, like, you know, faking it.
And that's such an empowering thing especially to understand.
Especially Patrick, but, you know, we all know that.
It's such an empowering thing to understand that no one knows what they're doing, and that's okay. And it's okay to just, you know, try, make it up as you go, or just, like, do whatever you have to. There's no solution. There's no manual. It's that's, just a thing you have to trust yourself and, like, build a team around you.
It's reassuring when we're talking about, you know, you doing your art or me doing my small businesses. It's a scary thing when you think about that there are nuclear weapons out there. That's Dan Carlin. I actually, like Dan Carlin was just talking about that if you really think about, you know, how scary it is that there's really, if there's not a conspiracy out there, if there's no Illuminati, right. If there's not a new world order, like, that's kind of maybe the best case scenario, is if the Illuminati and the Rothschild and all, you know, the new world, or if all that's true, then we're actually safe. If there is no conspiracy, that's scary.
Perhaps another answer to your question would be cancer.
Ooh, yeah.
But
that's not irrational.
That's not irrational.
That's just nobody inevitable.
Nobody gets cancer anymore. That's cancer. So 1990s. puking noises in the background. Well,
nice bright.
All right.
Yeah, on that beautiful note, happy Sunday to you guys.
Yeah, happy Sunday, everyone.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.